called to be the chair today. I'm Commissioner Bateman from Tola County. Our other members are out of town. I appreciate the opportunity to go ahead and do this. First thing on our agenda is we'd like to go ahead and welcome everybody. If you'll please sign the roll and contact information we don't have, we really appreciate it. Everything needs to be updated. Would be good. The first thing we have, the minutes to be approved for the June 14th meeting. If I could have anybody make a motion to do that, or have they all been read, Scott?
Yes, the minutes have been sent out, so we need a motion on those, and then after that we'll do run around the room and do introductions.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to approve the minutes.
Okay, that motion to be approved. You have a second?
I'll second that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, your name?
Davis. Barrier.
Okay. If we can just start with Will and go around the room and introduce everybody, where they're from.
Will Summerhorn, Salt Lake County, Regional Planning and Transportation. George Tenera, Salt Lake County Municipal Services. Reverend Kip, Utah Department of Health.
Andrea.
Oh, Andrea, WFRC staff.
Since I'll be.
Sean Seeger with Mountain Land Association of Government staff.
Brett Milburn, Davis County.
Andrew Gruber with WFRC.
Myron Bateman with Tola County.
Scott Hess with WFRC.
Jory Johnner, Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Jeff Silvestrini, Mill Creek.
Heidi Goodhart, UDOT.
Phil Sarnoff, Lake Utah.
Jennifer McGrath, UTA.
Carrie Down, UTA.
Chris Jones, not Dan Bergenthal, but I'm his proxy today. Salt Lake City.
Barry Burton, Davis County.
Jeff Euler, Davis County.
Carmen Freeman, Herman City.
Alex Roy, WFRC staff.
Stephanie Tomlin, Karen Pierce. Catherine, WFRC staff.
Richard Miller, UTA.
Tim Collins, Betsy Byrne, National Park Service.
Matt Zamora, UDOT.
Brian Moore, Riverton City.
Mark Benedict, Regional Southwest.
Emily Price, Salt Lake County Health Department. Sarah Knudsen, Salt Lake County Health Department.
Steve Call, Federal Highway Administration.
Roger Morgan, Utah Federal Transportation.
Travis Olson, Weaver Morgan.
Tom Bottle, Salt Lake County Planning and Development.
Okay. We'd like to start out with public comments. And anybody that would like to offer a public comment, we'll give them 2 minutes. So is there anyone that would like to address the committee and give a comment? Seeing none, we'll move to the chair report. Two things, the governor quality of life announcement. Governor Herbert announced plans that he'd like to see an additional 1,000 miles of family-friendly trails and bike paths over the next 10 years to be built in Utah. He wants this to be access to schools, work, outdoor recreations, urban, rural areas. And this is a goal that I think is important that will impact the region. I know in Tooele, Kim's been working and getting 3 different things started by the health department. It seems like the local governments out there can't get things started, so she has a trail in Anaconda and one called Rogers Road and Rabbit Lane that she's working on. And that'll be the first trails that the health department is going to be actually paying for to get done. Which is like they kind of got grants to do other things. The second thing is the tour of Utah wrapped up on August 6th, and that tour crossed all regions of the state. Went from Logan all the way down to South Jordan, including the Heber Valley, Snowbird, and it's finished here in Salt Lake. And I think it brought a highlight. I think it's also one thing that other people who are visiting the area can see and look at that tour of Utah and say, hey, this is something I might want to do. But I think that's a very positive item. When we get towards the end of the agenda, I just will ask if anybody's going to Minnesota on September the 10th. That was kind of interesting. So I'll ask that. So maybe you think about if anybody's going to be doing that. Next is the Tiger Grant TIP discussion. Richard?
I appreciate the opportunity to update you on where UTA is with the Tiger Grant.
Hey, do you mind talking into the microphone just so we get it on the recording?
Hope I can still turn around. So I'm UTA's project manager for the Tiger Grant. And does anybody remember the last time I reported to this group? Okay, that was gonna, oh, you do? I was going to dig through my prize bag, but I thought, oh, I don't know if anybody will remember. Anyways, back January 18th. And back then, we were still trying to get our hands wrapped around this Tiger Grant and the First Mile, Last Mile program. And where we were at that time, if you remember, is UTA submitted a Tiger Grant requesting $28 million of Tiger money to fund First Mile, Last Mile projects. And they received $20 million. So there was an automatic $8 million plus shortfall. But at the same time, it was really great news that there was a $100 million program of active transportation projects in Utah. Those were in Wasatch Front and Mountainland Association of Governments, two MPO areas. This was a great program for the whole region. So, between January and now, we spent a lot of time sorting through the projects, figuring out how we are going to move ahead. And there happens to be a Tiger Executive Committee, which consists of Jerry Benson, which is UTA's CEO President, Andrew Gruber and Andrew Jackson from Wasatch Front Mag, and Carlos Braceres from UDOT. And at that time, we had been working towards UTA funding, not UTA, somehow, the MPOs, UDOT, and UTA funding this gap that we didn't receive from the Tiger Grant. At that meeting, the executive committee told us that they were not going to fund the gap. They still totally support this Tiger project. They support active transportation. But one of the main reasons was they felt that these active transportation projects just needed to go through the regular planning processes that the MPOs have. So we moved ahead from there. I've spent the last several months meeting with our local partners and entities, numerous meetings with them, some more than others. And when we sat down and talked to them, we explained that we had a budget issue since we didn't have all the projects funded. And we wanted to do a couple things. We wanted them to prioritize the projects. Then we would ask them to complete a concept report so we knew exactly what the project consisted of, do an estimate so we had a good idea of what the estimate would be, and then get an idea of what their matching funds were. And if you look at any project process, this is just a normal process going from planning study. You get the Tiger Grant in there, and you go to the scoping and concept, and then you can move ahead, you know, with your project. A couple things to note was that the locals really stepped up. The Tiger Grant requires a 20% match on the Tiger dollars. So a $20 million Tiger Grant, overall $5 million match. We actually have a $16 million match with the locals. So this tells you how important these active transportation projects were to them. There's also other funding sources coming into some of these projects that we're working on getting in there. But it was really good to see that these projects were important to the locals and they still wanted to move forward with them and they were willing to put money behind them. So that left us with a Tiger program of about $36 million. Now on top of that, there's still what I talked about back in January, this other $75 million of First Mile, Last Mile projects, which is mostly being delivered by UDOT. Those projects are programmed on the UDOT STIP. So that gives everybody an idea of how we've moved forward, going from having all the projects, not enough money, to vetting out the projects. Okay, this took a lot of collaboration, and it was really good to see that as we met with the planners, the city engineers, the public works directors, that they're all willing to work with us to develop this list. We had a few areas to screen these projects on. First of all, the environmental. We had to make sure that whatever project was prioritized by the city that we could get the environmental document completed with a categorical exclusion. We didn't feel we had the time or the money to do environmental assessments or environmental impact studies. A lot of the projects, which are great projects, for example, some of the bike lanes that Salt Lake County has on their plans, they just couldn't physically be built because they required roadway widening, and the city, that wasn't in their priority to widen that road right now. And then there was just the requirements with federal funds. So some cities had maybe a small dollar amount bike lane, and they said, we're going to go ahead and do that on our own. We don't want to use federal money because it costs too much to build this little bike lane with federal money. So a lot of these projects, even though they might not have made the Tiger List, are moving ahead. And also with the $100 million first mile, last mile, those projects are getting complete even as we speak. So I think right now there's probably like $4 million worth of those projects complete. So Scott has up here where the projects are in the Wasatch Front. Little dots there. They range from Ogden all the way down to Draper. So a couple things, if I step back to the grant a minute. The grant was announced in August of 2016 that UTA received the Tiger Grant. We are looking to get grant signature by December of this year. So just because we have been awarded a grant doesn't mean we have the grant. We have to go through five items, and I think I talked about those before, that the USDOT wants before we can get to grant signature. The first one is they need an approved scope, schedule, and budget. So we think we're really close to that. We need approved performance measures to show how these projects affect our transit ridership. We need to have the environmental documentation complete, which we're working on. We need to have all of our partner agreements signed. And the last step was all the Tiger projects need to be in the MPO TIP and then roll into the UDOT STIP. So that's why I'm here. Scott says this is the first part of getting it into the Wasatch Front TIP. So I'm here to report that we actually have a project list. Andrew will receive a letter probably in the next day or two, just saying that we have a project list. We'll share our project list with them. It's not officially public yet, but it's got some great projects on it. We went from, and this sounds worse than it is, we went from 343 projects in the grant to 104 projects that are going to be actually that we construct. Like I said before, a lot of these are being built, or the cities will build them when they go back and do some type of preservation treatment on their facility. So Wasatch Front has actually 30 local projects and 59 UTA projects. That might sound like a lot of UTA projects, but the UTA projects are really small dollar items. They're like bike repair stands, bike lockers, and wayfinding signing. I think if you add up all of the UTA projects, the $36 million is somewhere around $900,000 in UTA projects. So the majority, the 30 projects in Wasatch Front take up a big chunk of the money. As I said before, there's no way we could have done this without going out and meeting and working with all of your city engineers and planners. They were really good to prioritize the projects. They know their budget limits, and it was really good to get out and know and meet these people. And when we're done, 5 years after the grant signature or sooner, it's just going to be awesome to have all these active transportation projects out there, along with the other 75 million first mile, last mile projects too. So with that, are there any questions?
Do we have a map of where these projects, you said there's 30 or some odd,
yes.
Do we have a map showing where those projects are?
This map actually shows them.
So this has, so the little blue dots are the projects that happen at the UTA stations along the fixed guideway tracks and transit lines, and then the little green projects are first last mile points, and then there's some lines. So you can see Tooele gets some bike lanes. Just because of the scale of the map, it's difficult to show that. And up until, you know, recently we have a GIS file with all of these projects, but that's almost too much information. It's getting down to the pre-environmental level. So we don't have a good in-between, just as we've been refining this project list, and this was developed just as a quick snapshot way to show the smattering of projects across the whole region from Pleasant View down to Provo.
But yeah, is there a request about your city?
No. Okay. I was just curious where they were.
Is there a descriptive list available of the projects?
Yes.
No.
Well, it's not available yet. It will be after we inform you and Andrew of it. You know, we want to be totally transparent on this. We're going to put the list out on our webpage.
Okay.
We're going to put the dollars out on our webpage. We have nothing to hide. It also requires that we have each local entity give us their local match before we start. So there will be deposit accounts created, and all that will be out there for anybody to view at any time also.
So can we agree that once we have that list available, as soon as we have that list available, can we make it available to all the members of the Active Transportation Committee? Everybody's on the mailing list, so everybody can see that.
Yes.
Okay.
At UTA, we felt that the list needed to go to you, Andrew, and Sean's Andrew.
Okay.
And from there, we felt it was something you could inform the local entities of. We could if you wanted us to, but we really felt it's your list.
But the reason I want to mention that, I think that's a good point, Andrew, because if they are going to have matching funds, they need to know exactly. Does these entities know?
They know, and they told us what year.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Now, all that may change, right? I mean, if there was a change in leadership or something, but they pretty much said, from today's date, we will give you X amount of dollars July 1st of this fiscal year.
But what's our procedure? Let's say that an organization can't match. What happens to those funds?
So far, everybody has committed that they have the funds to match. And there's a lot, and it's the local match that we're asking for. So on most of the bike lanes, Salt Lake County is providing that match from a revenue source, local revenue source they have. But the local entities have said, yes, we want these projects. We have them in our budget.
And in the original Tiger application, there were funding commitments that came with the application that basically made mention that the cities knew there was a match, that the percentage match requirement was there from the get-go on this. And so this has been shoring up all of those funding commitments, but it came initially in the application. Jen McGrath, when shepherding that application through, received all of those funding commitments from the cities at the time.
However, if some local entity, a city, decides to not do their Tiger project, since we are overmatched at such a high rate, we can redistribute the Tiger dollars back into the program. It's not what we want. I mean, this project for UTA is all about the locals. There's very few UTA dollars and just buying bike lockers and bike repair stands and some signs. It's all to help the locals provide access to our rail stations, both commuter rail and light rail, to increase our ridership and close these gaps that were out there, that maybe somebody had to walk all the way around or something, and now they can just go through where our sidewalk's complete.
Richard, on the performance measures, do you have a quick synopsis of what that involves?
So we had several calls with the USDOT, who will be tracking the performance measures, and we are going to use our existing performance measures. They suggested to keep it simple, report what you already have, and we are using three measures, safety, and two of them are ridership, and they'll be reported yearly, because that's how we report on those measures. Some of the safety measures we may have to work with UDOT on their safety, traffic and safety accident database, because there are a lot of crosswalks that may be outside of, they're not that near to the UTA stations that we're putting in there that we just want to track. So.
Richard, on the performance measures, you're measuring those regionally, not every single project is going to have?
Correct.
Okay.
It's on the UTA system.
Okay.
We can do other performance measures, but they will not be part of the grant. And I think, we've always talked about having some other performance measures in there. Other items that might be important to us. But for grant reporting, we were told to keep it simple, and we want to keep it simple.
The thing with FTA is, if you suggest a particular performance measure and you put it in, then you're held to that standard. And right now, we know that we have some deficiencies in terms of counts and data, and so what we wanted to do was make sure that we put forward into the grant the things that we knew we had and that we could get, And with the idea that if we have more data available, we'll want to do additional analysis for ourselves that we will share with FDA, but that we won't be held to a particular standard on something that we don't have the ability to collect that data for. Does that make sense?
Okay. Well, thank you very much. The active transportation study, benefit outcomes, I'll be interested in that report. I'll be Bill, Jan, and Carrie.
Where are we going? Hi.
It should work.
Yeah.
It does work.
You're in charge of the clicker.
So we're really excited to talk to you today about the active transportation benefits study. This is something that's been a long time coming. We've been working on it for a long time. Maybe not put a time frame to that. Just to give you a little bit of background, you know, we all know that Utah is nationally recognized as being a place where people love to bike and walk. We're known for our outdoor recreation. We're known for having very supportive policies, and we've got a great environment for active transportation here. But we haven't done a really great job of monetizing the benefits of that active transportation, of those investments. So that was really the driving force behind wanting to put together an active transportation benefits study. We wanted to be able to have some quantitative data to use to help us in our planning efforts, to decide on policy, to talk about programmatic decisions, and also to make really informed decisions about our investments. That's something that we didn't really have a lot of to begin with. So we looked at a statewide study, really concentrating on the environmental, health, and economic benefits of active transportation benefits in the state. Go to the next one. So I think this is, you know, other than the outcomes, which are also very exciting, we'll be talking to you about in a minute, this I think is one of the most exciting pieces of this study. This is just a list of the funding partners for this study. We had over 40 stakeholder groups participate in this. And I mean, we had, you know, all the usual suspects. We had our MPO partners and UDOT and the State Health Department, but we also had people like the Governor's Office of Energy Development, Select Health. We had numerous health departments from across the region. We had, you know, folks in Tooele, we had Weber Morgan, we had Davis. We had a lot of participation. There was a lot of interest in this and a lot of excitement around it. And I think, you know, this is how we do things here. This is what we do really well, is we build these really strong partnerships. And I think that this speaks to how important this information is to a wide variety of people in a really broad geographic area. So I'm gonna kind of turn it over to Phil to let him talk about the study.
All right. So I kind of want to talk about, there were four basic things that came out of this study. And are they all on the UTA website as well? They're on the Bike Utah website.
I do not.
Okay, so they're on the Bike Utah website, and it's bikeutah.org/AT benefits study is the website where those four documents are housed. The first one of these was the literature review. And let's see how many times we can see Tom Millar in this presentation. Every single photo.
No, where's Tom?
I know, this is his big moment, you missed it.
He's famous.
But the literature review basically goes through all the comparable studies that have happened around the country. There are about a dozen other states that have done similar studies, and our study was drawing from many of these studies as well to come up with the metrics and to determine what the best performance measures were to quantify the benefits. So I won't go into too much detail on that. If you'd like to read it, it's on the website. Kind of the meat of it is are two documents, one of them being the economic impacts of active transportation portion. And some of the key findings that came out of this, you know, one of the things that I wanted out of this study is like Utah was, let's figure out, like, give me a number, because the ski industry has their number and the extractive industry has their number. I was like, we wanted a number for active transportation, bicycling, walking. And that's 425 million and 3,500 jobs across the state, which for an industry that doesn't have a ton of, still is working on getting all the support from the top down, is pretty impressive. The fact that it's been done by businesses and local communities. The physical activity, the health and health insurance cost benefits. So this number for every mile that somebody who is getting less than 150 minutes of exercise walks, they're saving $3 in healthcare expenditures, and for every mile is 0.75 that they bike. And then Carrie's gonna talk a little bit more about how these numbers came about and how communities can start using this tool and one of the tools that was created to start coming up with these own numbers. But there are case study examples as well, like the Murdoch Canal Trail, what it costs to maintain and what that economic impact is annually, which is pretty impressive. It's a phenomenal facility, and it also provides this benefit to the citizens of Utah County. Dead Horse Point in Moab, again, same thing. You know, it's a pretty low cost investment, and you're getting a really significant economic benefit from that facility. In addition to that, best practices manuals. So there's a manual that basically goes over what communities should be doing if they want to improve their active transportation. It talks about implementing facilities, developing programs, and again, I'll let you folks dive into that on your own. But can we switch over to Carrie's stuff now? Well, probably one of the best tools is this calculator that they created. So for every county, they basically created multipliers for each county to say, if you're going to put in a certain piece of infrastructure, host a specific event, you plug all these things in. If you're in Washington County or if you're in Kane County, put in these different metrics, and it basically will crunch all the numbers and kick out what those economic benefits are, as well as the health benefits. So I'll let Carrie talk about that, because it's way out of my league.
Did you do anything on air quality?
The air quality, I would say the environmental piece of it was not as pronounced in speaking to them. It's tough to quantify. And I mean, I've had conversations with John Larson here at WFRC, and we do not have, one of the challenges of this study in general is we do not have great numbers for the number of people who are biking and walking in Utah. There's great numbers for people who are driving cars. There's pretty terrible numbers for figuring out how many people are biking and walking. And that presents a real challenge when trying to quantify the air quality impacts that it could have. Well,
the only reason I mention it is because we look at funding and mm-hmm. such for that. That seems always at the forefront, particularly right. along the Wasatch Front. Air quality is a big issue. And if we're going to get ourselves in the line to get funding, I think right. that needs to be some way we can give some statistical data of what we're doing to contribute to the air quality. I think we go along.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, like I said, I mean, this is something that a bunch of us, UDOT and WFRC and ETA and myself and a bunch of other partners have been working on, is trying to get better numbers, because in the entire state of Utah, there are how many counters? Bicycle and pedestrian counters?
What does it?
25.
25. Which doesn't give you, I mean, and most of those are on the Murdoch Canal Trail, mm-hmm.
yeah.
which is one facility. So
it's
we're
a
really
huge barrier to us being able to provide that data. Just without that count data, we're really limited on mm-hmm. what we can do with that, which was something we discovered throughout this process and was a source of frustration for us, frankly.
And even from the, you know, the Utah Office of Tourism, they don't have great counts for the number of people who are coming here or taking trips inside of Utah or coming into Utah to do trips that are related to biking and walking. So there's a real deficiency, and it presents a real challenge.
Okay.
Because we don't know where we are. We can't say this piece of infrastructure will help to improve air quality until we know what the...
But can't we take a statistic of saying, hey, if someone rode their bike from point A to point B versus a car, we should be able to have something in terms of what?
Oh, you can absolutely quantify that, but we don't know how many people are doing it. So you can say, you know, for every mile it's this much in emissions, but if you don't.
I think this is a great point, an important point that the mayor is making, and the challenge is that we sort of intuitively know it, and we can anecdotally ascribe air quality benefits to bike utilization. The challenge that we have is the sort of harder quantification of that information, either, you know, in today's info from real counters, and then also one of the things we're working towards is better incorporating into the transportation modeling predictions for the future. If you implement this type of bike infrastructure, what is the utilization going to be? And then that actually can fit into our air quality monitoring and predicting for the future. So there's an effort underway to have the technical capability and data catch up with what we all intuitively know. And so we're working on that. As we go further down that path, I think we'll be in a much better position to more defensively articulate those air quality benefits, which then will be helpful in a lot of different ways, including advocating for more funding that ties with air quality.
Right. And you're right. I think the funding really, future funding, is going to really tie to air quality, particularly as we look at the growth doubling in the next 30 years.
Yeah, I just, by way of example, some of the funds that the MPOs allocate are the CMAQ program, Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality program. We're required to have real quantifiable projections of the impact, the air quality impacts of various investments. And for bike projects, it's hard to do that in a way that sort of meets that quantifiable standard. So it's part of our sort of shared work program to go from this kind of information then to move forward on that quantifiable data. So it's a great point, we're working on it.
Okay, thanks.
And you're absolutely right. Scott and I presented at a conference in Vancouver last fall, and you couldn't ride more than a quarter mile, half mile, without crossing a counter. Every time you went into an intersection or went out of an intersection, there was a counter. Again, they know exactly what's happening with all the bicyclists and pedestrians because they've invested in that infrastructure. So I'll turn it over to Carrie to talk about the calculator here.
Hi, everybody. Again, Carrie Doan from UTA in the planning department there. Jen asked me to do this really exciting project and effort.
Only Carrie would describe this Excel spreadsheet exercise.
It's just a spreadsheet. It's only a spreadsheet. But I have, I'm going to walk you through kind of the tabs, and we're not going to go through all of them. There's a lot, but I want you to know what's sort of how it works and what's in them. Please start with the README. There's a lot of good information in here. There's a lot of hints of the tool. It provides some of the limitations of the tool. Yes, there are limits. And just notes, I'm not going to go over them with you now, but if you use this tool, when you use this tool, please start with the README. This user interface, and for those of you who can't see, I'm just clicking on the tabs on the bottom. This is the kind of the basic, what happened to our
format? Your page display.
It's best to look at it in landscape, and
yeah. Look at it
In a tabloid. Well, a bug. So anyway, let's keep going. Let's not worry about the format. It's all supposed to fit on an 11x17 in landscape form. But basically, there's a user interface page where you input information in the shaded areas. Everything that's not shaded is basically locked and has a formula, or we don't want you to mess with it. The page, the user interface page, has the outputs in these graphical forms that are supposed to fit on the page. I don't know, Scott, do you have any idea why it's doing this?
I don't.
Maybe you could throw it into, instead of page view.
Top right.
In the middle.
Not here. Isn't this the top tab? Or
yeah, you here?
There you go.
And just do normal.
There you go.
Now Zoom. Perfect. Yeah. Thank you, Heidi.
Thank you so much. Nope, much sorry, everybody. Okay, let's just move on. There's the shaded areas that you have input, and the outputs come out in these graphs. There's nothing happening here because of our project is a nothing. But we'll get, I'm going to go through the whole thing and then I'll come back to here. These are the graphs, the outputs that have annual benefits and like this one-time, a one-time economic output is basically from the construction of the project itself. But we'll go come back here. This page is really important. It's called Project Adjust and Default. There's some adjustments that go to the projects based on what they are. And there's also, we've provided some default numbers for usage in case you don't have usage. You just want to see what would happen if you build a project and use the usage that we have come up with as defaults. And so these numbers are calculated. I've used some assumptions. I'll let you read more closely as to how I came up with them. Some of them are zero for good reasons, and they'll stay that way. And that's where the defaults come from. Now, these are the counties that are involved. You must pick a county, and this is all a county analysis. So, because our data is provided by the county, in county metrics. So all of the rest of the tabs are basically what the study calls, and this comes right from the study that Phil and Jen were talking about, these multipliers. And a lot of big numbers in here, again, all based on counties, and I pulled them straight out of the study. These are not my numbers. These come from the work that you all helped fund, and it's from the InPlan software that was used for the study. And it has all of these different variables. Health for cyclists. This is overnight trips. Okay. Again, I'm going to let you dive into here. They're all locked. You can't do anything with them. And that's they're all used for the calculations in the user interface. Any questions before I launch into using this thing?
So the The default numbers, though, are explained in the README?
README and a little bit on that page. I've tried to kind of give a general kind of idea of if you click on something and it's got a calculation in it,
right?
Say like that number, 3 times 10 times 100 for, what do we have? It's probably, the trip length times the number of users times the days per year.
Is the source data, if you, do you have a link back to your original source material?
No, this is best guess. There's no source material for this. It's a reasonableness.
Yeah, anything in this, as you use it, the number of users is probably the one that you can affect the most change in, up and down. And so over time, utilization of the Strava data and our counters to nominalize or normalize total users across different types of facilities across the counties will make this tool, we'll just kind of fine tune it over time with those specific numbers.
We can refine these defaults. The challenge is that this is an annual analysis, and we all know that biking, walking sometimes only happens in the summer. And so it's really at user's discretion at how you kind of think about the usage. The usage is absolutely the toughest part. If you don't like these default numbers, it's a great segue into going back to this user interface. Because you can put in your own.
We hope that people have enough information to put in their own. The defaults are there in case you don't have that data, so that you can at least get a sense of what it would look like if that was your default number. Does that make sense?
Right.
And the beauty of the multiplier is those are all very geographically specific. So when you're doing a calculation for something in Salt Lake County, it's going to be very different than the calculation for Tooele or for San Juan or for Washington. So it's very specific to your region, which I think makes it really special and useful. This is actually useful.
And we've gone through a lot of really technical stuff. And when Carrie puts this, there's like 10 cells to fill out, and then it'll punch out the number. I mean, so the technical side aside, the actual utilization of the tool is extremely easy to just go in and quickly say a project costs this much money, it's this length, what is my economic output expected for this project?
The amount of work that Carrie has done to create this thing, I can't even describe to you. I mean, it's incredible what she's created here. And because of all of the incredible work that she's done, should be very simple for somebody on the user side to just plug in a couple of numbers and get these really great outputs. And to maybe play with some things and look at what it might be if you did this or that. So we're hoping that on the user end, we feel like on the user end, it's very user friendly. It's got a lot of really great information. It's very complex as she's describing it, but that's all that she.
Let's go through it. Chris, if you, in the meantime, could pass me down Scott's cheat sheet on the Weaver project. So the way this works is you have to pick a county, and there's a drop down. I think it's a Weaver project that we're going to look at today. So you have to pick, of course I picked the W, I have to scroll all the way down. So you pick a project, and project type matters. So there's also a drop down for the project type, because obviously a trail will take different construction than bike lanes in the street, as well as sidewalks for pedestrians. So think about your project and what it, the type of project, and you must pick best fit. You know, if your project is in here exactly, then you have to pick the one that fits the best. Okay, so this is a Weaver project. We're going to say it's a road infrastructure project with bicycle and pedestrian facilities. So how many miles? This is not a drop down. You get to put in, but it should be in miles. Scott, this is a 0.8 mile project, right? 0.8, yeah. So, according to Scott, 0.814. So, this is a new feature since Scott did this. We thought about, what about if it's a bridge? If it's a bridge connecting two trails. This next line allows you to think about people using this project, but also the adjacent infrastructure, so that the length of their usage for their health data, for all those sort of multipliers that require the length of the ride or the walk. You can increase the number if it's more than the project. Your project really should be connecting things so it's a contiguous active transportation experience. Scott, is it one thing? Can we put a different number in here?
Yeah, you can put, that was your first. That was based on the first round of this, so
yeah,
you
so can put. How many miles is this?
I put 10 because reasonably somebody might access 5 miles on either side.
Okay, so the estimated cost of this project is $650,000. This is the capital cost, and then the operating cost is an annual amount. That's important. So these numbers are just kind of a check for you to see what your project is. Now, the next step is to pick. What kind of analysis? Are you going to use the default or do you want to put in your own? So let's just check these default values. So the whole thing loads these numbers, the total numbers at the bottom. You don't have to do anything. And you can see our graphs have changed. This is what the total output for just building it.
So on the left was the money in, right?
Yep, this is what it cost to build it. And this was the total economic input. The in-plan, just so you know, and this is part of the study so you can study it yourself, is the actual construction costs, the indirect costs of all the people who got money because of the construction project, and the induced costs, which are what those people spent on the grocery store. Did I get that right? I'm not an economist, but it's something like that. So then, these are where all the multipliers come into effect. So there's annual economic output. Oops, sorry. And I have allowed for you to put three different sort of versions. Your kind of your best guess, and then, it's more than you hope for, or maybe this project doesn't live up to what I hope it will. And so you actually have the option to put all three of those in, and that's what these three rings are. And these different colors separate all these various parts of the annual benefit.
So without spending too much of your time right now, that's what that is talking about. And these, it's just, I felt like we were missing part of the picture, and that is the number of labor years and labor income that is also part of the multipliers and the study's outputs. Okay, so that would be, this is how those the graphs work. So the other option is to input your own. So if you want to input your own, it's zeros out of all the defaults, and you need to go in here and put in numbers. Here's where you have less than hoped for, estimated use, and more than hoped for. And I've provided a couple of variables to kind of help you make the calculation that I did in the defaults. And I'm just going to throw Scott's numbers in here really quickly so you see how this works. And I can take questions while I type, but I can't promise that I...
Also, there was a request to send out the short presentation that has the link to this group. That's okay, so.
This is the outcome of the studies that I've always hoped would be an outcome. I mean, when you read something like the Active Transportation Benefits Study, you can read through it. You can get those static examples of Moab and a few other places that are really tourist heavy. But how do you relate this, you know, huge document of spreadsheets into your own work? And this is the way. And I just can't express how much work this must have been, and also how powerful this tool will be, because even underestimating, if we do less than hoped for, the economic outcome of these trails that we have is huge, and the health outcome of these trails is pretty remarkable. And to be able to share this with the city council, with your elected officials, your county commissioners, with, you know, building this into applications for funding, for TAP funding or other recreational sources of state monies, and be able to say that for our $600,000 investment, we'll have over $1 million of economic outfall, you know, on day one, and then all of the other numbers. I think this could be an ongoing tool that we'll continue to use. We're going to consider how we can use this in our own funding evaluation criteria and really tooling our projects to make sure that we're getting the best economic and health benefit possible.
And I think utilizing it for projects that are already on the ground too. Yeah. Because that's what basically happened.
It should be calibrated that way. This is like what we call in the beta version. So please, if you use this and you find things that are buggy or you just don't think are right or really kind of unreasonable, let me know. This is not a done deal as it is.
Well, we also want signs, real quick. I think your walkers per day less than hoped for, I think you meant half a mile, not 5 miles average per walker.
So 0.5.
Should
be 0.5.
Yeah, thank you.
Also, you know, as we...
Well, let's see what happens.
As we get more data, you know, we can update this to be more and more and more accurate over time. So the more information we have, the better this tool can be for you. And we are happy to update it as needed.
Yeah, I have a question, and the question is, have you identified, you talk about every county in order to get data, have you identified or maybe worked with Brett in identifying somebody that can be, because when you get to the rural areas, they might need to be a little bit further, maybe if they went through your program, but if we could get accurate data and identify people, so I don't know if you identify people, I think it's easy to watch that script and say, hey, we have these five counties, but when it comes to the rest of the state, I wonder if we really should work with the Utah Department of Health and try to get some identified so you get some good accurate information. Because again, it comes back to taking that to your county commissioners, to your mayors, and saying, hey, by putting these walking areas that's close to people's homes, this is how you're going to help to benefit your people. The one in Paiute where the income level is so low, it's like everybody else is like 0.3, 0.2 in Paiute County. It's like 0.11, but they've got a lot of force. And if you do what Moab did with theirs, you can say, hey, if you put some trails in there, this is going to increase your activity in Paiute. And so I think if there's a way we can identify people to fill this out, especially other counties, it could really
help. To fill it out.
Hmm?
To identify people to fill out the
calculator? Data.
Oh, so yes, the data
as far as walking
the data is based on the county health districts. And what I did is there's a couple of counties that are in one district, so you can see I've used the health district.
I actually tried county for Duchesne.
And applied the county to the district. And so some of these numbers are the same because they're the same district. Like, I think this is the state average, and so some of them.
Are you talking about identifying a champion within each area?
Right.
I think this is also like actually reaching out to communities and letting them know that this is a tool that's available.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the DOT, I'm responsible for all the small area, non-MPO areas of the state. And this is definitely something that is definitely at the forefront in our planning department. Will be using it.
This is probably a great thing for us to get back together kind of as a stakeholder group and identify those.
So well, the real thing, most of these counties are understaffed. This tool would be great for them. It's something they could never put together. But you can say to this person, hey, I got help for you. Because it's like they're championing the cause, but.
We might be able to find some assistance within our team, too, to be able to help with that.
And as we're pushing this out from the help end, this is a big part of us being able to get in the door to say, not only is this data going to be helpful and how we can utilize that in planning, but what other data we can bring in as help to be able to talk.
And this is a good time to get this stuff put together because right now there's going to be, it's the mayor election year, and there's some mayors that just don't want to do anything with active transportation, but if you get this information with the new people, the mayor and council people, you can educate them about active transportation.
We had a couple questions.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. One is, you described this as beta. And so if I go to somebody in the county, mayor, commissioner, whatever, how confident are you with the numbers? And that's one question. The other is understanding the source data, I guess you could say. Well, I pick that up as I start reading through your reading pages, and so that when some of these questions come out, like, how plus or minus what is the estimated use?
Yeah, I mean that it's the county commissioner ought to be.
You talk to your commissioner and say, I want to know the dollars and cents.
Then you can say, well, this is what I assume the usage will be. You know, I would suggest in that case that you do input your own and that you're transparent about this is the economic benefit if this is the usage. If that's the case, then I'm confident about the numbers, but I'm not confident about the usage numbers because we have.
Gotcha. So the multipliers you
have. Yes, solid. Yeah. Yes.
What Carrie's talking about is, you know, we have some assumptions that you use for the default. If those assumptions about the usage aren't correct, the number won't be correct. But if you use your own input, you know, the thing is, the default values are. They are valuable in and of themselves. So you could say, if we had usage of X, we would get Y. We don't know what that usage is going to be, but or if usage was this, it could be that. So when you talk about it in that way, you're being transparent, you're being honest, and the numbers are real. What you don't know is who's going to actually use the truck. The number could be higher, the number could be lower, but it gives you a jumping off point for a conversation to say that these kinds of investments give you these kinds of returns.
Well, as you say that, that's a good reason to have those three categories.
Yes.
The ranges.
Yeah, it gives you a range to work with.
And this kind of goes back to the counters, too. Like, if you have counters on trails of Weaver Pathways, you could say, hey, this is what we have on the river trail, so this is roughly what we can estimate for this new trail we want to build. So that's where this will only get better as that data becomes more widely available. So, thank you.
Yeah, so I had a question. I did this for a test run the other day. With Salt Lake City on a trail project. I say the heart of Salt Lake City, the 99 corridor, so it'll connect Surplus Canal to Immigration Canyon. And I had a hard time estimating the predicted miles of facilities because you talked about this area, and there might be 100 miles of bikeways, but all the connection facilities, plus the sidewalks. So that's what I struggled with the most, and I'm giving suggestions on how to conduct that better.
I think a lot of reasonableness has to be applied. Like Chris pointed out right away that the average walk of 5 miles, you know, that's Not true.
Yeah. 5 miles is too big a number.
People struggle to get 10,000 steps, right? So a lot of reasonableness. If you've got a connected, like, a good example of, and this may or may not help you, but I want to say to the group, is there's the new Jordan River Parkway Bridge in Salt Lake City. You connect that, you're connecting what, 80 miles?
100.
Yeah. So you're going to put 100 in here say that you know, that 100 people are going to be doing 100 miles, you know, 100 days? No, they're probably not. So I think that if you think about a typical person or a typical commute and kind of what they would, their path, I know that it puts a lot of judgment on your part, but I think that's kind of what we all do, right?
Yeah.
So I would certainly suggest that you limit that connected miles to really connected. Like if it's a bridge, you only connect it to the trail that's connected to the bridge on each side and to when it stops. Like if for some reason there was another break in the Jordan River Parkway, that it would stop at that break, not do the whole miles. You know what I'm saying? So you don't have to connect everything that's close, just exactly what's connected to your park.
Where you can.
A little bit. I mean, I think, you know, the average walk trip is half a mile, the average bike trip is 3.1, so you just draw that buffer around our project.
It's always best to, if you're just, again, transparent and open about what are the assumptions that you're using to make those calculations, and then talking about a range. So I'm assuming a 3 mile, you know, 3 miles on each side, but if a person were to take a longer trip, or if more people use the trail, we could be, or fewer people, we could be somewhere in the range of this to that. It's not an exact number, but again, it gives us a jumping off point and a talking point and some numbers to work with, so that, you know, we're starting sort of from zero in a lot of these cases. So at least now we have something of substance that's real, that has data behind it, that we can feel confident about, and we can start having these kinds of conversations that if we make this kind of investment and if we get this kind of usage, that these are the kinds of outputs that we'll see. It's not perfect.
And Jen, I think you made a really good comment though, that go back and do this on things you already done.
Yes.
Because well, you're saying it's beta. I mean, we're getting there. We've got solid stuff behind this. But just like any forecast model, it's only as good as the data goes in. And if you go back and do it again to validate what you've got, then we're able to see how it can move forward.
And the confidence starts to
very much.
Commissioner Milburn had a comment, but I have a question for him. Go ahead.
Well, I appreciate the conversation here, and I was great to hold off as you're talking more of the technical aspects. But I just wanted to make a comment or two regarding tool and the breadth by which you're looking at all the different elements. I'm looking there at tourism and events and how this plays with economic development. I think it's absolutely critical and applaud you for thinking along that line. It was mentioned earlier, meeting Tour of Utah that was just held last week, and we were lucky and blessed to have Stage 5 in Davis County, started in Layton and ended in Bountiful last Friday, and this is the third year in a row that we've hosted a stage, and this will help me start putting some value to that, but I know it's been there. Some of it I can't necessarily quantify. I mean, you can't put a figure on the international coverage that in the eyes of the world that are on Davis County in a variety of ways. One is just our community as a whole, but then also to see the Antelope Island and our community and how beautiful it is and things of that nature. The crowds that come out, it's kind of a synergetic thing. Folks that come out that might not even ride bikes, but you've got a world-class event right in front of you, coming by in front of your house. It bolsters and boosts the enthusiasm of the riders, but then all of a sudden it gets them, it's like, oh, maybe I ought to pick up a bike or be a little bit more active.
How many people attended that?
I mean, it's hard to say, you know, put actual numbers to it, but we probably, what do you say, Barry and Jeff? You know, by the time we get to the finish line, we probably got
on the whole route thousands,
but even downtown Bountiful, you probably got between 3,000 and 5,000 people.
The reason why I ask it, because I know there's a lot of people from Tula went there. And then the other thing with the Legacy Highway, it's amazing how people from my county tell me they go out there to ride the Legacy Highway.
Yeah, the drive.
Just because they enjoy it. And
yeah, absolutely. And so
you're going to benefit in Davis County because of what you had. And then our county commissioners say, well, who maintains that? Who pays to keep up the trail system? The county park system? Or?
Well, that's you know, to address that question on maintenance aspect, that's one thing that we're having discussions at with our own active transportation committee.
We'll talk to Barry about that afterwards.
Is establishing, at least for those trails that are more regional insignificance, that go from community to community, like Legacy or some of the others, that they really ought to be maintained or governed by a bigger group.
They end up every city took care of their own trails.
So you have some continuity and some consistency and a high level of standard. One of the challenges with Legacy Trail was when it was put in is, yeah, fantastic trail, but no concept or thought to, okay, how is this going to be maintained? And all of a sudden it's, you've got a number of cities that goes through, and each one of them looks at it a little bit differently. Well, yeah, we'll put some money into it. No, we're not going to put any money into it. And then
No consistency.
Then the user, pretty soon you can tell which community you're in because it's maintained differently. And then we come and we're working collaboratively with everybody, and the county is kind of taking the lead on that, but we're working through, okay, how do we fund it? And that's where Prop 1 is just phenomenal for Davis County, because it now gives us a resource to do these types of things. But one last thing, as we talk about economic benefit, I have some cities that we try, we have some great ideas for some bike venues and trails and things of that nature. But I have some cities that are kind of going, well, you know, prove it to me that there's an economic benefit. This will help in that regard. But if anybody can help me with those that are saying, well, I don't know if I want people in my community. They might park in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Or it might bring, you know, they're afraid that it'll bring crime or whatever else. Instead of looking at it as, you know, I want it, but I want it for just my citizens.
Yeah. We have a city, Vernon, and we put a trail system. They're one of the largest trail systems in the world, United States, and they have one store. And the mayor does not want anybody to come into that area. Yet it's the only revenue source that city has. And it doesn't make sense because sales taxes would save that community about 50 homes, maybe. Yeah, we don't want anybody outside. That is amazing. Anyway, this is a great tool.
I applaud you.
Oh, sorry.
I have a question. So where you put the numbers in here for, you know, average use or estimated use, can you get the economic output of that? You turn this on its head where you say this is what this project costs and how much usage do we need to justify this as a break-even point, so that you could say, well, you know, we can, this project will pay for itself over the course of 5 years.
Yes, it'd have to be. I think you just have to start really low, uh-huh. and keep adding until you get
just sort of
just look at these graphs.
Change the numbers.
I think that anytime you spend any capital money, I don't think you're going to get the economic output. There's no way to spend capital in a community and not have a greater economic impact if you include direct and indirect and induced economic impact. I think we can't do less. So this graph here, I think, will always have this relationship, although it may be, the difference may be smaller. This graph here, it's a great question because I played around. Chris caught that my mistake. Here's the 5 miles in the less than hoped for in the average miles, which is too much. There's a, oh man, that can't be right. So I just want everybody to watch the donuts here. If I change this back to 0.5, that's how it works. It's just pretty much instantaneous and you can get that change. And I think once you use this enough to understand, like, wow, that's way more special event chunk than I imagined. Check your numbers, thank you.
To that question that was just asked, I guess, you know, I can understand that question, and that's kind of the mindset that we always look at is, okay, what's the return on investment? How's it going to pay for itself and all that kind of thing? I think that's a valid question, but also I hope we don't get too hung up on, okay, we're not going to do it because it doesn't pencil, so to speak, because there's so many things that come out of these, you know, a project that don't really have a dollar value to them, but or direct dollar value, but some quality of life or health, all kinds of things that you just can't say, okay, it's paid for itself, so to speak.
Okay,
we don't do that with the road.
No. To try to just wrap it up, Mayor, Mr. Greenman, you had a comment?
No.
I think it's going to help build bike trails to Tooele County.
We are.
Okay, so that's one thing. But in order to justify things like that, we need tools like this. And so, and I don't know how you guys pay for your trails, so I might want to talk to you if it's a city thing, or do you try to work with the county?
No.
County, okay. Okay, let's go ahead and wrap this up. Questions afterwards, go ahead and talk to the people.
No, but I just want to say, Terry Jones seriously deserves a round of applause for this. This tool exists. Thanks,
Terry. Okay, well, we move to the Bike Utah program. Bill?
Hi, I'm Phil Sarnoff. You might remember me from the last presentation. So last fall, we launched a youth bicycle education program. It's called Youth Best. And I kind of we're wrapping up the end of our first year. Actually, the last day of the program is August 31st this year. So I just kind of wanted to loop back with everybody here, let them know what happened with the program, and also kind of give you some information about where we're going with it and what some next steps might be and where we can use support from people on this committee. So for those of you who haven't heard of it, basically it's a 5-hour on-bike program. We do 1 hour a day over the course of 5 consecutive days. We have a lovely truck that UTA was nice enough to provide us with a nice wrap on. Full of bicycles, we have a train and helmets. We have a trained instructor who basically brings the truck to the school, usually during school hours, and works with a whole bunch of kids to teach them all about bicycle safety and to get them excited about riding. There's no cost to schools or students. We wanted to make it accessible for everybody regardless of financial capacity. It's mobile, so as the truck implies, so we can bring it all around the state. We have a tendency to kind of do it in northern Utah at the beginning of the year, and as the weather gets a little bit colder, we kind of migrate south, and then we migrate back north in the spring. And so these are all the schools and programs we've been to. It's, I think it'll be about 44 as of the end of the year. Some of them have actually been repeats and schools that we've done for 2 weeks in a row. Buffalo Point, the first school we did, we were there for 2 weeks and hit all the fifth grade kids and all the sixth grade kids. And then in the summer, we've worked with some schools that are year round. We've also worked with YWCAs, Boys and Girls Clubs, some local recreation departments to provide the program to them. This is kind of what it looks like. You know, we have I mean, hundreds upon hundreds of photos of kids like loving it. We get almost no negative feedback from the kids because you're not in math class. And this is our outputs. This is updated as of last week. I think we're at like 2950 or 60 right now. Like I said, number of schools that we've been to, schools and programs we've been to, increase in bicycle safety knowledge. We do a lot of assessment with the program. So we do assessment with the teachers. We have teachers do a tally before the program and after the program to see how many kids walked or biked to and from school. And then after the program, same thing, so we can get an actual behavioral count. There's a lot of variable in there. Was it a rainy day? Did they wait 3 weeks and it snowed? So we have some challenges there in terms of those numbers actually being really valuable in assessing the behavior change. But we do quizzes with the kids. They take a quiz at the beginning of the program, at the end of the program, and we are seeing about a 77% increase in their knowledge of bicycle safety concepts, you know, how to fit a helmet, how to signal, all sorts of things like that. And actually, one of the schools we were just at last week, we had been to them previously during the school year, and we had our first kid who got 100% on the pre-quiz. So there's clearly some, which I was like, that's bad for outcomes, great for, you know, you don't want that kid to be, you know, bumping up those pre-numbers. But it's showing that the information that we're giving to these kids is lasting a little bit. They're not getting a good grade at the end of on the quiz right after the program and then forgetting it 6-8 months later. And then we've also partnered with a couple of different nonprofits or profit organizations. We get a lot of feedback from kids on the quiz. We have a question at the end that says, is there anything you want to tell us? And some we get a fair number of kids who say, my family can't afford a bicycle. So, I mean, that's a really big barrier, obviously, for riding a bike to school. So we were able to partner with the Bicycle Collective, and there's another nonprofit called Bikes for Kids, to give away some bicycles. So we've been able to give away bikes, helmets, locks to a handful of kids. We don't want to become a bicycle distribution program, and we don't want schools to think that, oh, this program's going to come in and all my kids are going to get bikes. But in those circumstances, we work with the schools to identify kids whose families might not have the means to provide that. We also do surveys with the parents after the program, and probably the couple of key questions for us are, prior to the program, has your kid asked to walk or bike to school? And after the program, has your kid asked to walk or bike to school? And we're seeing about a 34% increase in that, which is great. We want to see, we want the program not to just be affecting the kids as well, but the parents. So we ask them, has your family, anyone else in your family been more interested in walking or biking after the program? And we're seeing about a 53% increase. So we're starting to see that little bit of carryover from the program to the household. So these are from the counts. Like I said, I mean, we can't really speculate and say, oh, we increased it almost 400% on the number of kids biking to school, because there are a lot of variables in there. But at least we're not harming it. It's not as if the kids are going through the program and all of a sudden biking drops off because they think it's unsafe or whatever. So, and in terms of walking to school, again, we can't conclude 100% that we're having that impact, but at least it's not having a negative impact. In addition to that, we do bike walk audits that we have the schools fill out. So we'll have a teacher, an administrator, or a parent fill out an audit of the school, basically to get a feel for what is the school doing to encourage bicycling and walking. And I would say that the feedback is not overwhelmingly positive in that regard. So we asked, do they have a designated person who's responsible for encouraging biking and walking? And only a small percentage of those actually have somebody who is working on that. We asked, do they have a committee that's working on it? And again, it's a pretty small percentage of schools that are actively working on trying to get more kids walking and biking. But when we look at the program outcomes, a lot of them want to be doing more. They said it was an eye-opener, they want to implement this stuff. So that's a place where, and Heidi and I have spoken about this at length in regards to the Safe Routes to School program and how that program can actually start working with schools a little bit more proactively. We see our program as kind of a foot in the door. We know that education is only one piece of the puzzle. Infrastructure is probably the most important piece. But we see our program as a foot in the door with these schools to say, okay, great, you're interested. Here are some resources that are available, whether they be technical or financial resources. And there's clearly demand. I mean, we've only gotten feedback from about a quarter of the people, and more than half of that feedback is, I want to do more, and I don't know what to do, and I don't have the resources to do it. So, moving forward, we're recruiting a school start program. We're about 25% of the way booked for year two, which starts at the beginning of September. We're especially looking for Title I schools because those are schools often where they don't get these types of programs, and a large percentage of those kids are walking and biking to school out of necessity. So we want to make sure those kids especially are having this opportunity. And then working with individual schools, and this is where we could really use the support of the communities. If you have schools in your communities that would be interested in hosting the program, have them reach out to us. And if you have schools that are interested in trying to build up the number of kids who are biking and walking, have them reach out to us as well. I mean, we see our program as trying to find that person within the schools who is maybe going to be a good advocate for pushing along, getting more sidewalks built, getting crosswalks built, getting bike infrastructure implemented, developing bike trains, walking school buses, all these things that it's actually going to take. So if people have questions, this is the contact information for Jace, who's our education director. So if people have questions, you can obviously email me, but Jace is a good contact if there are schools that are interested in bringing the program. So.
You know, have you had much resistance from, I know our health educators, Kim, with our health department, have contacted our school district. I don't think they take advantage of it. Did you find some districts that are very supportive of it, and then others you have to show the,
yeah,
kind of like the graph that you had before, that, hey, this is a benefit to these kids, especially with the Title I schools and things like that.
Yes.
I think the social skills and other things that can be developed in this is a real winner.
We have not reached out to school districts specifically, and that's been intentional, because once you reach out to a school district and the school district says, no, we're not interested, that cuts out all those schools, which may have, I mean, schools, we found, tend to operate pretty autonomously. They, to some extent, I mean, we've seen that. Some schools are really receptive and others are not. So we didn't want to cut out schools with that broad brushstroke. We absolutely get some schools who have zero interest. And I mean, we've had a tough time in Utah County with the schools there. It's just, maybe we haven't found the right people. And that's the other thing too, is who's the right person? Is it an administrator? Is it a teacher? It's finding that champion within each of the schools. And
maybe with the health, where we have school nurses, it might be where we could approach, say, hey, North Lake is where Title I school. Hey, this would be a great program. Explain the principal and then go that way. But it's really the champion of it.
Yeah, and that's the toughest thing. And that's why we're trying to spread the message about the program as wide as we can, because really, it's a needle in a haystack. I mean, we're trying to find that person or those people who are supportive and willing to take the time to coordinate with us to bring the program in. So if there are connections that people have at schools or schools that might be receptive that weren't on that, I know everybody probably didn't read through that whole list in 30 seconds it was up there, but if people have connections at those schools or with local health departments that might have connections.
Yeah, and I think that's probably been working out. Go ahead, Brad.
And you wanted to mention you're also working with charter schools and others.
Yeah, we're especially in year one, we're pretty flexible. We're like, our goal was 3,000 kids, which we're on track to exceed by the end of the month. So we were like, get them in the door. Let's get as many kids through the program, because that really is the best way to sell the program. And that's why rescheduling has been not easy, but quite a bit easier than year one was in terms of scheduling. Is now we have this. A good reputation, not just a reputation.
Yeah, but it's nice you said that, because we have one charter school where we have actually a painted active transportation line. Maybe we could look at that one school and say, hey, it's your chance, because it's nice. You're not going to a superintendent, going to the actual, maybe actually that school have like a 2-mile track to come right back to school. So hey, that's a good idea.
Yeah, we're totally flexible on which schools. We obviously have a preference towards schools that do not have the means to bring this program in otherwise.
Any other questions before we move on to the next? Bill, thanks. It's a great program on that. Next, we have Scott Hess with the RTP process update. Oh, there you are, Scott.
Okay.
So that board works up here just fine.
Yeah, it's kind of.
Oh, usually it does.
Put out of the
collected everybody's phone.
All right, so the next two will be really short, and I want to leave the balance of time for agency and county updates, but I've been trying to keep everybody at the ATC aware of what we're doing on our regional transportation plan update. We're right in the middle of our cycle for our regional transportation plan update for 2019-2050. We'll be adopting a new regional transportation plan for all modes and land use come July 2019. But right now we're working on version 2 of the preferred scenario. So we've gone out and visited with your communities twice, plus gone out to the regional technical advisory committees of planners and engineers, and are working on an update of the base and priority map, which we've had hanging on the wall here and have been working on since about 2008 through the UCATS process. And we're taking all of the comments from our scenario workshops, partner meetings, stakeholder meetings, and public comments, developing facility recommendations based on speed and volume, which we're going to call our new vision map for future development, and then have developed project selection criteria tied back to 10 regional goals. The next piece that we're working on right now is our phasing criteria. So we're going to have, instead of a region-wide map of priorities, we're actually going to have phased projects the same way that road and transit do. We've got draft criteria that we're going to review in October with the Active Transportation Committee. That will be reviewed by local planners, UDOT and UTA, in September. So we have till the end of the month to have our phasing criteria developed. We'll consider what methodology we'll use for weighting the criteria and things like this economic outcomes, that calculator, some things that we've been thinking about how to weight projects in order to develop that phased list of projects for what would make the most benefit and impact to be developed first. And really consider when a project is needed and what makes it a higher priority than other projects. And MAG went through this process. They developed a sort of a phase one of their active transportation line work. And in talking to Jim Price, it was what the locals and he felt like they could fund and develop over 10 years, which is phase one. So we'll be coming out to local communities and asking, you know, one, what their priority is, and also realistically what we think we can fund over the first 10 years in a fiscally constrained model, the way that we're able to do with our three federal funding sources that we distribute. So that's going to be, October is the next major update of that. We'll have maps, we'll have some phasing criteria, and be able to roll that out and show you a little bit more of an update.
One other thing we're looking at too is just the interaction of the active transportation projects with transit, future transit projects, and future road capacity increasing projects. So we're looking at it at a high level and working with UDOT, UTA, and we'll even coordinate with the local communities on what can we fit within a corridor, right? Because you could imagine if we do all this planning in kind of silos, if we say, well, this road needs to be winding and we need this transit project, but it's going to require some additional right of way, and oh yeah, we need this active transportation project, but it needs another 10 or 12 feet. You could easily take a corridor from at 60 feet and now it's 120 feet or something like that. And so we're identifying those overlapping projects, and we're working with UDOT and UTA now, and we'll also take that out to the local communities when we have our workshops too. We may not be able to come up with all the solutions. Some of them will need additional study. Good examples of those are Foothill Drive's has done a study that has looked at how to incorporate everything within a pretty tight 99-foot corridor. Redwood Road's another corridor that throughout all of Salt Lake County that's looking at that. And so some of them we may be able to resolve during our regional transportation plan process, but others might just be, hey, let's acknowledge that there's some future work or refined study needed on these corridors. So.
And the last note with this is that we're working with our partners, UTA, UDOT, local communities, to make sure that we develop one map that everybody references. So we're, you know, it's the one map to rule the world of active transportation, and we're hoping that, you know, UDOT's lines are reflected accurately in this map. The new Salt Lake County Active Transportation Implementation Plan lines are in there. First Last Mile whole program is in there. And then all of the locals maps. So as we've done new active transportation plans, so Kaysville-Farmington was recently adopted, Riverton, Ogden City, We're snipping out the old information and dropping the new lines on the map. So when we reach out to all the local communities and ask for their updates, we need that information in order to make sure that we're all consistent, because hopefully this map will be referenced not only at a local level, but all the way up to a DOT level. Thank you. So then the next... The next one, just really fast, right now is the time to start thinking about projects. We have our upcoming letters of intent. Those will be due in October. We don't have the final date yet for the letters of intent, but this will be any planning projects through our Transportation Land Use Connection program. Those would be funding new active transportation plans through your communities, small area plans, form-based codes, and then also the TAP, CMAC, and STP. So making sure that the planners and the engineers have talked to each other on what road projects you might be applying for, as well as active transportation projects. One of the biggest bang for your buck is to get active transportation projects rolled into your larger road construction projects. So you can basically get, you know, quote, free bike lanes, new sidewalks, that sort of thing, out of a major road capacity project improvement. So be sure to think about those. And if you have any questions, get a hold of me or Ben Wethrich in our office as we look forward to that. Right, or just reach out to me, since you should have my email, and we'll make sure you contact the right person. But that'll be October, and that's noted down here at the bottom that the program letters of intent are due, and that'll be coming back out to you. You'll start seeing emails come around the next 2 weeks.
Okay. Do some county updates if they have some things that they'd like to share with us. Go ahead.
I know it's 8 months in advance, but save the date for the Utah Bike Summit. It's going to be March 13th. At the Utah Cultural Celebration Center in West Valley City. Our keynote speaker is Gil Penalosa, who is the founder of 8 to 80 Cities.
This is March 18th?
March 13th. Tuesday, March
13th. 2018.
Yeah,
okay, I'm going to put the date down there.
He used to be the Parks Commissioner for Bogota, Colombia, about the time when they started doing open streets events. They were one of the first cities in the world to do open streets. And he's on the board for a nonprofit and founded it called 8 to 80 Cities, which encourages communities to build for everyone from 8 years old to 80 years old. So,
and what's it called?
Utah. The nonprofit or the
event? Bike Summit.
It's a Bike Summit.
Utah Bike Summit, yep.
Utah Bike Summit. Yeah. I just want to put it right in my calendar.
And so he has a bunch of TED Talks and stuff, so you should check him out.
What's his name again?
His name's Gil Penalosa, P-E-N-A-L-O-S-A.
Okay, and they'll be at the?
Utah Cultural Celebration Center.
Okay.
Another agency update. UDOT is hosting our second pedestrian summit, which will be on Thursday, November 30th at the Viridian Center. You can go to UDOT's active transportation pages to find the registration link for Eventbrite. We're also taking some calls for abstracts and presentations. If anyone would like to submit any ideas, they can send those in to pedsummit@utah.gov. So we're still kind of in the planning stages of our pedestrian summit, but Carlos Braceros will be one of the keynote speakers for the day. It should be pretty exciting. And then our Road Respect program is finally undergoing the final phases of rebrand, and we'll be launching hopefully by the beginning of September. And that'll be a community active transportation planning program that will be focused on active, healthy, and connected communities. And we'll be able to deploy any resources that we have within the department to help communities accelerate and advance their active transportation initiatives, as well as establishing goals and objectives and all of those fancy things, in addition to, you know, getting plans on the ground. So as soon as that program's up, I'd be happy to give a presentation, an overview of the program.
Are we going on rides anymore?
We'll be doing community rides. So we just had one this summer, the zombie ride in Cottonwood Heights, and, you know, we had kids on Strider bikes. It was community focused, going through neighborhood routes. a lot more community focused. Doesn't matter what kind of bike you show up on, how old you are, what your fitness level is. It's more of introducing people to the amenities that already exist in their communities and then cultivating that conversation about what they can do to get them. Yeah, it's very exciting.
Awesome. Oh, go ahead.
Do you have an update from something we talked about earlier in the year, which was the Planners for Health group? This is some funding that the Utah chapter of the American Planning Association received from the national organization and the American Public Health Association. And over the past probably 6-7 months now, we've been working on how we can better integrate a lot of the planning and public health activities that are going on. The highlight is that we've had a couple of workshops where we've been able to see quite a few people. I don't have the exact numbers, but it was a significant group, both in the north and the southern half of the state, to talk about how planners and public health can get together a little bit better, talk the right language, be involved in the planning process earlier. I think that perhaps public health has learned more from planning than vice versa, but we're working on that. And one of the things that we really gathered from that was our very first assessment of the planning and public health community as to how we look at things and what kind of things we can actually work better on. And I think that would be actually a fun presentation to share back out to the group if we're interested in doing that.
Yep.
We are finishing up the project in September, and one of the things we have left is a roundtable discussion that will be happening in September to talk about those lessons learned, and I just think it would be really smart if we were able to bring back some of that information, both from the assessment and these walkability and general planning process workshops, back to the group.
Brett, I don't know how many people were in the southern Utah, but the one at UTA had over 100 people.
It was, I counted, did a rough count of almost 150. It was pretty tight in there. And we had close to 20 in the southern half, which we felt was pretty good representation. Yeah, it's actually really nice. I know that public health got started on this when we realized that we can't get everybody to a gym, and nor should we. We should probably, I don't know, be realistic and have people walk in their own communities. And we're finding that's having a much better impact overall on our physical activity rates when we encourage not only lifestyle physical activity, but providing the environmental and policy supports to do so. And it's been very, very successful for us since we really kind of dug in around 2008, and with a lot of our local health departments, the efforts they put in since 2013, we're really impressed with the not only the ability to have an impact on outcomes, but also the willingness of local communities to work well. When this isn't really our area, we don't build roads. But we know people, and we know what the issues are when it comes to how people interact with them.
So jumping off his health aspect, and every county kind of is different, but the public health department actually is a separate entity to the county. They have their own funds. And so in Tooele County, this is kind of innovative, but the health director has a goal to have a 25% fund balance. And now his fund balance is over the amount that he really had, is his goal. And he's taking $300,000 of his extra money in his fund balance and putting it towards active transportation projects in the county. Now, it'd be nice if you say the county commissioners need to match with him, but he's actually doing two trails with that money in Tooele County. He's doing, I hate to take this away from Kim because she's been working on that and she's back there, and she's with the health department, but they're doing a walking trail, which is 2.3 miles to spell the road up and down, paying for that. And then they have a railroad bed, which might be 4 miles long. It's called Rogers Road. It goes from Tooele to the Desert Peak Complex to the Utah Mill and Mortar Sports Park. And the debate is, do you use lime lines or do you use pavement? And as I met with some of the bikers, says, no, you're going to do a lot better if you go ahead and use pavement, even though there's a maintenance cost there. But I thought this was interesting. One health department's take from what you guys have said, they've done their community health assessment. Active transportation is one of the top three items. And because the cities and the county haven't stepped up, they're stepping up and saying, okay, we're going to start putting some trails in, and hopefully, you know, the municipalities and the county will participate in doing that. So we're going to try to take part of our transportation money and do the other side of the Smelter Highway. So there's a walking trail going up one side and down the other side. That's a new project that the health department put together up there in 12. That probably is pretty good. Any other
updates.
Davis County is happy to announce that this past Sunday, we reopened the Legacy Trail. Ooh, after 10 months, over 10 months of closure to install a Questar gas pipeline. We learned that closing a major trail system like that is just a bad idea.
I watched that project.
Yeah, and we hope to avoid that in the future. It just closes down too many opportunities for people.
Be a great case study moving forward.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of comments from people upset about
we're already
that.
Getting, I was out there on the trail with the contractors the other day, and people are just so excited to have that reopened and usable again. There's still some work on the shoulders and landscaping that needs to be done. But on another note...
Jeff, before you go off of that, I mean, is it something that the counties or others would consider as... I mean, you don't normally just shut down a road for a year and then tell people they have no alternative route.
Yeah, right?
Would, you know, making them provide an alternative route, at least maybe out or around or something like that.
And they did that. They actually did that, but it's still very difficult. I mean, Redwood Road is not a great alternative.
It's not the same as Lane.
No, it just isn't, you know. So
well, maybe something comparable.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay.
Well, the pavement looked good. Said you want to go look to Clearfield.
Yeah. So on another note, we are in the process of implementing a grant program in Davis County to get out some of our Prop 1 funds to cities and UDOT and UTA. We got 25 letters of intent, and our applications are due early in September. So not only road projects, but we got quite a wide variety of active transportation stuff for trails and bike lanes and sidewalks. So about $12 million in requests. So we obviously can't fund that much stuff, but there's definitely a need out there, and we're excited to do some stuff on that front.
Everybody wants to get free money.
Yes.
is that your total prop letter? No,
that's way beyond our total prop.
That was just the number of
requests. That's the people that...
Because our prop one was $500,000. Yeah. Our prop one was $500,000 every raise for the county.
Yeah, what's your county total? About 2 million?
We get about 2 million.
2 million, okay. But is there a grant process that you're putting towards people can apply, cities or whatever, and they pay a portion of the...
Correct. Yeah, there's a whole series of criteria and things that we established, and it's a matter of an opportunity to help and partner, and I think that's the key thing. And the other key component is we're looking at expending those dollars in partnership with cities. It isn't for, you know, to supplement filling potholes and things of that nature in their own cities, but it's something that has some sort of regional significance.
But I like this concept because, you know, these bike trails, you can tie them into regionally, and that's where I see the cities not participating. But if you do this, then you're helping everybody in your community, your county.
Correct.
So I'd like to have our people talk to you, Jeff, and find out more about the plan.
Yeah.
Is Jeff over the program?
Yeah, there's two guys right there.
Yeah, Jeff, we can help you.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay, Jeff and Barry, go ahead.
The legislatively created Transportation Governance and Funding Task Force has continued to meet, which is made for a fun summer full of lots of meetings. But, you know, there's nothing else we'd rather be doing than having lots of meetings during the summer.
Yep.
Commissioner Milburn serves as a member of that task force. There are three working groups, one on governance, one on funding, and one on land use, economic development, active transportation, and some other things. The basic process that's been going to this point is that there's been information gathering at the task force and also in those working groups. And the working groups are now moving towards developing recommendations to bring back to the full task force in the September-October timeframe in preparation for the legislatively mandated report to the legislature from the task force in December. It's entirely possible that that task force is going to be given another year of life so that it continues through 2018. But the objective now is that there will be some recommendations, at least, that could be incorporated into legislation presented in the next year's legislative session, the 2018 legislative session. All of the information about what the task force is doing, all the presentations, is all on the legislature's website, which is, it's actually, the website is terrific. So if you want to get info there, you can. I'll say candidly for this group, there has not been a lot of focus on active transportation specifically in the task force or in the working groups to this point. I still think there's an opportunity for that, but there's been more talk about road needs, transit, governance, funding issues, coordination of transportation and local land use. These things relate to active transportation, but there has not been a lot of focused discussion on active transportation. So I thought I'd highlight that to you. I think this activity of this task force generally is something that it's worth all of us paying attention to. And some of us have been doing a lot of it, but I would encourage everybody to pay some attention to what's going on there.
One last thing.
So we've got the mobile active transportation tours. The Southwest Davis County tour was supposed to be in the spring with Legacy Trail completed and has been bumped and bumped and bumped. So we're underway planning that now. So expect one more local tour. The Minnesota MAT coming up September 10th and 11th. We still have some room on the bus for that. So be interested to see if anybody's going. And then the Golden Spoke, as we've been talking about this year, the completion of the trail from Ogden Canyon to Provo Canyon. Been following that construction cycle of the bridge out there at North Temple and Jordan River. It's under construction. You can go and see pilings. It's coming along, but the completion date for that, when talking to Dan Bergenthal, is still end of November. I don't know if Barry, you remember the ribbon cutting for the Jordan River Trail in November 15th or so, and snow flying, and it was really very fun and windy and uncomfortable. But we're thinking of punting Golden Spoke to the spring and having an event that wouldn't necessarily be the ribbon cutting of the bridge, but it would be a celebration of the completion of the network at a time when we can all enjoy it, give everybody a little bit more time to come together and plan and
get in shape.
a little bit more headway. And I think that it's going to make for a much better community celebration. It would be prior to May is Bike Month, kind of that April time frame is what we're thinking right now, but continuing to watch that construction season. And then if the construction of the bridge happens to lapse past November, we haven't held ourselves to an event that we don't have a confirmed end date of that construction
cycle. So we're seeing like heads nodding. Does that sound like the right approach?
Yes.
Yeah, pick more certainty, do it in the spring.
Maybe doing it May 1st, like the kickoff for Bike Month, the first day, but I think putting it off is
good. Or the first day of spring or something.
Yeah,
like
something,
there's things
yeah,
to,
some
yeah.
Monumental.
Yeah.
How about the ribbon cutting? Will there be a ribbon cutting even if you're going to defer on the...
I'd imagine. Dan Bergenthal, I'd imagine Salt Lake City's still going to celebrate the completion of their bridge with a ribbon cutting, but... He's still, just been making sure that they're under construction and moving. I think at this point he's more concerned with getting a bridge done than celebrating its completion.
Which is the right thing to do for a project manager.
Yes.
It's project manager. Okay, you may day. Make what you do. That'll be the weekend.
That'd be good.
Our time is that. Anything else? Okay, our next meeting. Was on the bottom?
October 11th.
Okay. So appreciate everybody for coming. And then Barry.